Well, last week we started in Joshua chapter 8, verse 18, and we saw a successful attack against Ai that followed an attack they'd had in our previous lesson against the city that was unsuccessful because of sin in the camp and also because they were relying on their military strength and not the power of God himself. In this case, in the successful attack, Yahweh provided the attack instructions, the plans, told them to set an ambush using a group that would be between Ai and the nearby town of Bethel. And then the main group was near the city entrance. And the people of Ai saw the main group and they went out to pursue them. And much like this unsuccessful attack, as the people from Ai came out, intentionally the Israelites in the main group retreated. And so the city people, the leaders, thought they were having another moment of routing them militarily. And so they called everybody out of the city to go after the Israelites, to pursue them. And Joshua stretches out his javelin, and he was placed down the valley. And as he does so, the ambush group then goes into the city. They take it. They begin burning it. The retreating Israelites turn back and fight. And before everything is done, 12,000 people from Ai have been put to death. The king is kept alive. They take spoils and livestock, which was allowed by Yahweh at this time. Ai was burned to the ground. The king was killed, hanged on a tree. At evening, he was taken down, and his body was placed in the entrance to the city, and stones were heaped up on it. And after the battle is really something that should not be missed. Joshua builds an altar at Mount Ebal, and he used no cut stones, and he burned in building the altar, and he burned the offerings, and he also had peace offerings. And it says it was done according to the book of the law, and the book of the law was even written on the stones. Half of Israel was placed on Mount Gerizim, the other half on Mount Ebal, and they read the entire book of the law, including curses from and blessings. The curses were stated on Mount Ebal, and the blessings from Gerizim. All of this came out of instructions that Moses had given. And this was specific obedience. Yes.
Could you tell us what chapter you're on? I missed that.
Okay. Well, last time we started in chapter 8, and that's what I'm talking about.
Okay. Thank you.
And they, Moses had written all of this out that was to be done when they entered the promised land. And here they were at the very places that Moses had told them that these things needed to occur. And so it was all done as commanded by Moses. And this wasn't a small event. I mean, it was a major thing to prepare the rocks and to write all of the book of the law on the rocks and to erect it as a monument and to build this altar and then to read the entire book of the law, which we don't specifically know that we have. Could have been the book of Deuteronomy. Could have been other things. Certainly include the laws that were given by Moses in the book of Deuteronomy. And then we went into chapter 9. And kings in the area, and kings are over generally cities or maybe in some cases a few cities, but they heard about what happened at Ai and Bethel. And they gathered together to fight Joshua. And the text then moves on and kind of sets them aside. And we begin talking about Gibeon, which was southwest of Ai, not far. My guesstimate is somewhere around 7 miles, probably. It's a larger city. But they have a quote by the scripture's description, crafty response. So they dress themselves up, they're play acting. They set themselves up to be an envoy, and they set out. They're wearing bedraggled clothes. Their sacks are wore out, their shoes are shot, their wineskins are patched, their bread is dry and crumbly, And they show up and talk to Joshua and the leaders of Israel. And they say, we're from far away, but we want to make a covenant with you. And the Israelites aren't very sure at first. They're, I think, quite appropriately hesitating. One of their questions is, how do we know that you're not neighbors of us in this land that we're taking? And they say, oh, no, look at our stuff. And they play the part pretty well. But what they primarily respond with is saying that, well, we heard about what happened in Egypt, and we heard about what happened with the Amorites on the east of the Jordan. And so Yahweh is a great God that's done well by you, and we want to come and serve him alongside you. And so we've been sent as ambassadors, an envoy, to establish a covenant. And so Israel grants them a covenant of peace, and they decide to let them live. And in that covenant, they swore an oath by Yahweh that they would do just that. Well, it doesn't take long. But 3 days later, the deception is discovered, and Israel actually goes to their cities, said plurally. And why did they go? They went because they heard about it, and they show up, and they say, so they confront them. And they say, why did you deceive us in this way? And they said, well, we were afraid, and we didn't want to die, which was a reasonable expectation based on what was going on with the other conquests of the Israelites. And so the Israelite people are outraged at their leaders. What did you get us into? Why did you make a covenant with them? And so on. And they want to attack. But the leaders convince them to let them live. They said, look, we made an oath in front of Yahweh, and we're not going to risk offending Yahweh. So we're going to keep our oath. And so Joshua says, okay, you Gibeonites, you are cursed. And for the rest of your days, you are going to fetch us wood and water. And you're going to be carriers of wood and water for the temple and our needs for the temple. I said temple, tabernacle. And also for the people themselves. And so that's where we left off. But I want to go back and talk about that a little more, because time didn't permit to get into certain details. Let's start out by looking at Deuteronomy 7, 1 through 11. So turn back to Deuteronomy 7, and we're going to look at verses 1 through 11. Oops, too far. So this is a warning that's given from God through Moses. He says, when the Lord your God brings you into the land where you are entering to possess it and clears away many nations before you, the Hittites and the Girgazites and the Amorites and the Canaanites and the Perizzites and the Hivites and the Jebusites, seven nations greater and stronger than you, and when the Lord your God delivers them before you, you shall defeat them. And then you shall utterly destroy them. You shall make no covenant with them and show no favor to them. Furthermore, you shall not intermarry with them. You shall not give your daughters to their sons, nor shall you take their daughters for your sons. For they will turn your sons away from following me to serve other gods. Then the anger of the Lord will be kindled against you, and he will quickly destroy you. But thus you shall do to them. You shall tear down their altars. You shall smash their sacred pillars and hew down their asherim, and burn their graven images with fire. For you are a holy people to the Lord your God. The Lord your God has chosen you to be a people for his own possession out of all the peoples who are on the face of the earth. The Lord did not set his love on you, nor choose you because you were more in number than any of the other peoples, for you were the fewest of all peoples. But because the Lord loved you and kept the oath which he swore to your forefathers, the Lord brought you out by a mighty hand and redeemed you from the house of slavery, from the hand of Pharaoh, the king of Egypt. Know therefore that the Lord your God, he is God, the faithful God, who keeps his covenant and his loving kindness to a thousandth generation with those who love him and keep his commandments, but repays those who hate him to their faces, to destroy them. He will not delay with him who hates him, he will repay him to his face. Therefore, You shall keep the commandment of the statutes and the judgments which I am commanding to you today to do them. And so if we back up and look at, I probably didn't note the verse. It says here, you shall not make a covenant with them, right? Did I miss that? What were they to do with these people that they met? It's very clear. Destroy them. It's God's judgment upon them. And so their obedience is to do just that. You're not going to make friends with them. You're not going to have interaction with them. And so Yahweh even tells them why he did not want contact with the current residents. And why was that?
Steer them away from God.
Yeah, you're gonna wind up being friendly with them, and then to be friendly, you wind up worshiping with them, and out of that you're going to be steered away from God. But you are to be, in verse 6, a holy people. Why were they chosen? What's that? God chose to love them. I put the chose in there. I added that word. I hope that's okay. God chose to love them because they were a great people? No, they were the least of peoples. But he made the promise to Abraham, and this was his plan. And in verses 9 and 10, he gave them something to know and remember. What did he give them to know and remember? Take a glance down there at 9 and 10.
Was that
lovingly kindness? What's that? Lovingly
kindness?
Yeah, so know that the Lord your God is a faithful God who keeps his covenant and his loving kindness to a thousandth generation. You can plan on the consistency of God keeping his promises. Here they were several hundred years after Abraham, and he's still fulfilling the promise to Abraham, right? And he has loved them and been kind to them despite their sin and so many other things. He also, in verse 10, says, also remember, he repays those who hate him to their faces. So in this set of verses is an implied choice. Do you want to be the recipient of his good, loving kindness and promises? Or would you like to confront him and rebel against him and have him repay you to your face, to destroy them? And so that's one of the parts of what we get out of the book of Deuteronomy about how they're to deal with these people in the land that they're overtaking. Is, you're my holy people, you're separate, you're different. Holiness, in behind the word, is this idea of separateness, of being set aside, in this case, to be holy because they've been chosen by God to be his. And so we have that separateness in there that goes along with God making them holy for his own purposes. So keep the commandments in verse 11. Now I want you to go over to Deuteronomy chapter 20. And it's going to sound a little bit different, but there's a reason for the difference. We're going to start, we're going to read verses 10 through 18. Deuteronomy 20, 10 through 18. And we're going to have to get down a ways in here before we see why he's speaking differently than what we just heard back in the earlier chapter of Deuteronomy. So beginning with verse 10. When you approach a city to fight against it, you shall offer it terms of peace. If it agrees to make peace with you and opens to you, then all the people who are found in it shall become your forced labor and shall serve you. However, if it does not make peace with you, but makes war against you, then you shall besiege it. When the Lord your God gives it into your hand, you shall strike all the men in it with the edge of the sword. Only the women and children and the animals and all that is in the city and all its spoil, you shall take as booty for yourselves. And you shall use the spoil of your enemies which the Lord your God has given you. Thus you shall do to all the cities that are very far from you, which are not of the cities of these nations nearby. Only in the cities of these peoples that the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance, you shall not leave alive anything that breathes, but you shall utterly destroy them, the Hittite and the Amorite and the Canaanite and the Perizzite and the Hivite and the Jebusite, as the Lord your God has commanded you, so they may not teach you to do according to all their detestable things which they have done for their gods, so that you would sin against the Lord your God. So they're told, when you approach certain cities, offer them peace first. And if they take it, then they become your servants. But what's different about these cities? Very far from you. What did these Gibeonites come proclaiming? We're very far from you. Now, so then can we say, well, the Israelites are off the hook. They didn't do anything wrong then. Well, because what were they told by the Gibeonites? What were they told? Yeah, we're far away. Now, the Israelites had one moment of brief questioning that was wise. How do we know you're from far away? And the Gibeonites say, well, we heard about your God and we want to come worship with you. Truth? Was that truth?
No.
Well, part of it was, I think. They heard about these Israelites. They were afraid. And they were afraid for good reason. And they clearly knew about what happened in Egypt, or they couldn't have brought it up. So they had heard about what was going on. But they didn't provide much proof they were from far away except for their dressings. You know, they were, the Central Casting had done a good job with them. They were there and they looked like they'd been on the road for a long time.
Also, they're not on the list of the ones you should destroy. Who? The Gibeonites.
Yeah, sure they are. Gibeonites or Amorites.
Oh, okay.
There's a lot of that going on that, frankly, I didn't get it all traced down here and there. And did I say the right thing? Amorites? West, the east of Jordan, those were the Amorite kings, right? They were essentially descendants of Canaan. We're going to talk about that, too, here in just a minute. So they had a good question, but they didn't follow up on it. That little thing that was kind of bugging them, they didn't listen to it long enough. And they had a place to go, didn't they? Where could they have gone so that they could have made a wise decision? We got to pray about this. And Joshua clearly had pretty direct communications because he and God interacted pretty directly often. But nobody thought to say, wonder what God thinks. Is there a lesson in that for us? My goodness, yes. We try to figure out this world for ourselves. I've got all kinds of opinions about what the government ought to do and how I ought to respond. They might not be very wise ideas, but I've got them. And so they had their own idea. They became convinced, so they did what was right in their own eyes, so to speak. Generally, that's a bad pattern if you see that description in the scriptures. I do want to take you to another place, and that is chapter 9 of Genesis. Chapter 9 of Genesis. Still talking about what happened here with the Gibeonites. And so we're a long ways back in Genesis. As a matter of fact, anybody know what's chapter 9 about? What's chapter 9 following?
Noah.
We're back in the flood. We're just post-flood. And in chapter 9, God's giving the covenant of the rainbow. He also gives the covenant that he made with the whole creation, that he would never again wipe it out. Not the wipe it out was by the flood on the rainbow, but that the seasons would be there and the the earth would provide for that that which was living on it. But I want to go down to verse 24. Now, what's already happened when we get to verse 24 is they came off of the ship, the boat, whatever you want to call it. People that really know boats and ships say, oh, it's not a ship, it's a boat. No, it's a boat. I don't understand all that. That's fine. It was a very big structure that floated, and I encourage you to go to the Ark Encounter. It's definitely eye-opening. But when they came off, one of the things that happened was Noah planted a vineyard. And what did Noah do with the product of the vineyard? You know. He fermented some of the grape juice to make wine, and he didn't know when to stop. And he had too much, and he essentially, I don't know if the right words are passed out, but he was in a deep sleep, and in his deep sleep, he became uncovered. Who discovered the fact he was uncovered? Ham. How many sons did Noah have? And their names were? And Japheth. Right. And so Ham comes out, and what does he do after he's seen his father's nudity, nakedness? Yeah, and it's clear from the context that he didn't just go, oh my goodness, we've got a problem to solve. We don't want to dishonor our father. He's got himself in an awkward spot, so let's do the right thing by dad. No, he obviously came out smirking in some fashion and telling the story in a disrespectful way. And so what do the brothers do, Shem and Japheth? Yeah, they put a garment on their shoulders. They back in so they can cover their father without viewing his nakedness, and they leave. This is how Noah responds in verse 24. When Noah awoke from the wine, he knew that his youngest son, what his youngest son had done to him. So he said, "Cursed be Canaan, a servant of servants he shall be to his brothers." He also said, "Blessed be the Lord, the God of Shem, and let Canaan be his servant. May God enlarge Japheth, and let him dwell in the tents of Shem, and let Canaan be his servant." And then it goes on, Noah lived 350 years after the flood. So all the days of Noah were 950 years, and he died. Where are we? What's the name of the promised land outside of calling it the promised land? Canaan. Why is it called Canaan? Because Canaan had a lot of descendants, and Canaan's living there. And indeed, these Gibeonites are descendants of Canaan. And when Joshua looks at them and says, "You're cursed. You are going to be our servants forever. You're going to fetch our wood and fetch our water," it lined right up with what Noah pronounced back after the flood. And so they did indeed live that out, and there are other ways that it comes up throughout the history of the land of Israel, and they do remain in that role. And so Shem, who was his key descendant? I think you'd find it in chapter 11. We're not going to go read it. But Shem, it's out of the lineage of Shem that we get Abram. And Abram then is called out of the lineage of Shem. So sure enough, we have the descendants of Shem as descendants of Abraham through the promises God made to him, taking the Canaanite land, a land of people that were very much idol worshipers, and in their idolatry practiced evil things. And God is confronting them in that. And there is destruction of them by God's own judgment through the descendants of Shem / Abraham / Jacob, as they're here now taking the land that God's given them, but in taking the land, they're also exercising the judgment of God, and in this case, they're fulfilling what Moses said about the descendants of Canaan, who was the son of Ham, who had made fun of his father for his nakedness. All of it ties together. Questions, comments? Okay. With that, kind of hard on the clock there, we're going to start chapter 10. So let's go over to Joshua chapter 10. And we're going to start with the first 15 verses. Remember back in chapter 9 that there were some kings kind of concerned and wanted to come down and fight as a unit? Well, chapter 10 has something very similar. Now, it came about when Adonizek, king of Jerusalem, heard that Joshua had captured Ai, that he had utterly destroyed it, just as he had done to Jericho and its king, so he had done to Ai and its king, and the inhabitants of Gibeon had made peace with Israel and were within their land, that he feared greatly, because Gibeon was a great city, like one of the royal cities, and because it was greater than Ai, and all of its men were mighty, therefore Adonizek, king of Jerusalem, sent word to Hoham, king of Hebron, and to Piram, king of Jarmuth, and to Japhia, king of Lachish, and to Debir, king of Eglon, saying, "Come up to me and help me, and let us attack Gibeon, for it has made peace with Joshua and with the sons of Israel." So the five kings of the Amorites, the king of Jerusalem, the king of Hebron, the king of Jarmuth, the king of Lachish, and the king of Eglon, gathered together and went up, they with all their armies, and camped by Gibeon and fought against it. Then the men of Gibeon sent word to Joshua to the camp at Gilgal, saying, "Do not abandon your servants. Come up to us quickly and save us and help us, for all the kings of the Amorites that live in the hill country have assembled against us." So Joshua went up from Gilgal, he and all the people of war with him and all the valiant warriors. The Lord said to Joshua, "Do not fear them, for I have given them into your hands. Not one of them shall stand before you." So Joshua came upon them suddenly by marching all night from Gilgal. And the Lord confounded them before Israel, and he slew them with a great slaughter at Gibeon, and he pursued them by the way of the ascent of Beth Horon, and struck them as far as Azekah and Makkedah. As they fled from before Israel, while they were at the descent of Beth Horon, the Lord threw large stones from heaven at them as far as Azekah, and they died. There were more who died from the hailstones than those whom the sons of Israel killed with the sword. Then Joshua spoke to the Lord in the day when the Lord delivered up the Amorites before the sons of Israel, and he said in the sight of Israel, "O sun, stand still at Gibeon, O moon in the valley of Ajalon." So the sun stood still and the moon stopped until the nations avenged themselves of their enemies. Is it not written in the book of Jashar, "And the sun stopped in the middle of the sky and did not hasten to go down for about a whole day"? There was no day like that before it or after it when the Lord listened to the voice of a man, for the Lord fought for Israel. Then Joshua and all Israel with him returned to the camp to Gilgal. So, the king of Jerusalem hears about the covenant made with the people at Gibeon. And he knows that Ai was destroyed like Jericho was. And so here these Gibeonites have a peace covenant with Israel, and so they have great fear. Why would they have great fear? Why was the peace covenant with Gibeon a threat?
Enlarged the Israel army, for one. And a bigger to go against them.
Here's a big city. And the big city's kind of in the way toward the hill country, which we'll look at in the map in a little bit and see where all of these things lie. But it's a little bit like, you know, you can think of great wars when treaties are made and all of a sudden you've got multiple nations that you have to conquer, not just one. Well, here they had the Israelites out there, But there was a great city. Gibeon was a great city. And there was hope, of course, that Gibeon would maybe stop the Israelites. You know, they'd fight the battle. We won't have to. Maybe they'd stop the Israelites, at least pare them back some so they weren't such a great force. Something. Oh, no, they're friends now. So instead of being a protector, potentially, from the Israelites, they're now adversaries. At the very least, they're neutralized, but very well, as servants, they might be up here doing the fighting with them. And so the king of Jerusalem is fearful. And here's Gibeon that's no longer a potential ally. And so he calls in the king of Hebron, the king of Jarmuth, the king of Lachish, and the king of Debir. I probably should make some more of these. I didn't yet. But you remember, maybe you remember if you were here, we handed out a map. It's not a great map. I don't know a lot of the things about it. Exact locations for these communities is hard to determine sometimes. And I don't know which ones we're real sure of and which ones we're not. But you can sure see Libna down there has a question mark behind it. But Hebron's down in this area, this southern area. Ai is up toward the top of the Dead Sea area, east of it, west of it. And we're talking about this area down here. And that's called the hill country. And so these cities were in that hill country. And so they're all down there. And the king of Jerusalem says, we need to go do something. And so why don't you come help me? We'll attack Gibeon, who has made this covenant with Israel. And so we have five kings of Amorites. Amorites were in the lineage of Canaan. And they come down and they camp by and attack Gibeon. So here's the people that Joshua made the covenant with. And he wasn't very happy. None of Israel was happy about the covenant. But they made it in front of Yahweh and they're keeping their covenant. And now they're becoming a bit of a liability in human terms. Because what do they say to Israel? What do the Gibeonites say to Israel?
Help.
What?
Help.
Yeah, help. Come save us. Don't abandon us now. We're being run attacked by these five kings. Come quick. The kings of the hill country are here. So what does Joshua do?
Goes.
He goes. When does he go? Well, he goes in the nighttime.
Right.
As he's going, God talks to him. And what does God tell Joshua? Don't be afraid. Yeah. Why? I got it. I put them in your hands. I've already decided. You've got it. You will definitely succeed. Not one of them will stand before you. And so Joshua goes up in a night march from Gilgal, which, you know, these are not long distances, but if you had to traverse it on foot, you'd probably think it was plenty long enough. But as distances go, they're not huge. So they march up in the night and they show up. And it would be easy to say it was a surprise attack, and Joshua's nighttime strategy confounded them, confused them, whatever. That's not what the scriptures say, does it? Were these people confused?
Yes.
Why?
God
confused them. So I don't know what that meant exactly, but you can tell they didn't know what to do with themselves. They're like, what's going on? And I read stories that were interesting about some things that happened in the Civil War, where somebody hears a noise, and so somebody shoots in that general direction at night, and the next thing you know, they're fighting this big battle, but there's really no enemy there. There just was noises that somebody got started. Once somebody started shooting, well, then we need to help. We don't, anyway, those kinds of things can happen, but they're confused. So they're in this battle situation, and these five kings that have marched down to Gibeon are struggling with what do we do? They don't have a clear plan of response. But it wouldn't have helped them anyway, because not only was Joshua involved with a great slaughter, they ran in pursuit, followed by way of ascent toward Beth Horon. And when we see up and down in the scriptures, they don't think like we do. If I said to you, I'm going up to Wichita, would that make sense? Why not?
No, because it's south.
Wichita south, that'd be down, right? They're not directionally oriented, they're altitude oriented. And if you always walked by foot, you would be too. Okay? If I've got to climb a hill to get there, we're going up. And so they're headed up in this pursuit, and they make it clear to Makkedah. And if you look at Makkedah on the map, you'll see they did go north also, but they're up in Makkedah. That's where they wound up from their attack at Gibeon. And I said they went up. Depending on if they followed the lines on the map, they went north and then south to get there. But that's where they went. And as they're fleeing, who's doing the biggest part of the battle? And how's he doing it? Well, we need to talk about that. Because in the New American Standard, in verse 11, it says he threw large stones. What do we think hailstones are? They're made of
ice,
okay? And he keeps doing this. And I like the word through, because that implies to me, and maybe I'm just reading a little too much into that, that proved he was, that insinuates he was probably aiming, not just dumping them. But anyway, and more died from the hailstones in the New American Standard than the sword. So was it rocks or was it hailstones? So, well, let's go back and look at the original language. Let's look at the Hebrew. It's the same word both times. And if you go back and look at what is said about the Hebrew word in the better lexicons, it can mean stones, it can mean hailstones. The New American Standard, I don't know exactly why they used stones one part and hailstones another. Maybe they were just splitting the difference. I don't know what the thought process was, but it could have been rocks. It could have been big chunks of ice. But was it effective? Well, how do we know that? Yeah, God got more that day than the Israelites did. And so there were more deaths from these stones and hailstones than there were from other things. I tend to think they were really rocks, and I'll tell you why I say that. One option for that word is hailstones, but it also could mean stones. It could mean tablets. When we have the tablets that Moses had, same word or similar word, same root, it could mean marble. So it has lots of uses to refer to things made of stone. But maybe it was hailstones. I don't know. So Joshua then says in the sight of all Israel to Yahweh. So he didn't hide in a corner and say this. But this battle's raging. They're not done. And Joshua says to Yahweh, make the sun stand still in Gibeon. And let the moon also stand still in the valley of Ajalon. And so what happened when Joshua asked for that? The sun stood still and the moon stopped until all of the avenging was completed, except for the five kings, we'll find out in a little bit. And it's like the book of Joshua, the writer of the book of Joshua knows they're not going to accept this. So he says, is it also not written in the book of Jashar? Which, that word Jashar means upright. Is not written in the book of the upright? What was it referring to? We don't exactly know. But back, the book of Wars is also talked about in the Old Testament as a reference to great things that happened. You can find it written there. But the text says, the sun stopped in the middle of the day. It did not go down for about a whole day. One of the things about the way of reckoning days for the Israelites was, if I said it took a day to do something, it wouldn't mean the same thing to them. A day means the daylight hours. So however long the sun was normally up, add that much more time to it of the same amount. So if it was a 12-hour daylight day, then for another 12 hours about, it stopped there. Now, everybody wants to say something about this, and we'll get to that in a minute, but verse 14 says, there's been no day like this before or after where Yahweh listened to the voice of a man, and then Yahweh fought for Israel. So the sun and the moon stopped. So what happened here? Well, things that people like to say that they believe happened. One is, well, it was an eclipse of the sun. So there was this eclipse that lasted a long time and it spared the heat of the sun for the Israelite soldiers. So they were able to keep going better. Another thing they like to say is that there was a local refraction of the sun's rays. When you refract light, you kind of bend it and it goes somewhere else. And so they're saying, well, the sun really moved, but something refracted in the air so it stayed light over there. Some would like to say it's a poetic description, that it actually didn't change the time, but they were so successful it just felt like they had a whole extra day to get it done. Well, I'm going to say no, it stopped in the sky, but that still leaves us a little bit of an interesting thing to think about. If you give consideration to when the sun moves in the sky, is the sun moving? Well, actually, we could have fun with that because it's very, very, very complicated to describe. But you actually could set things up where the earth stands still and the whole universe makes wild swings around it. Well, I don't think that's really the way the universe works. And it requires a lot of strange motion. But if it stopped in the sky, then do you... Well, so what had happened? Did the earth stop moving? Stop rotating? It didn't say it did. What's that?
If it did, gravity would cease.
No, I don't think so. Gravity's not dependent upon motion.
Nope.
Everything else would keep moving.
Well, if it stopped suddenly, we'd have some interesting stories to tell. If the laws of physics still happened. But here's the deal. It's an irrelevant thing to contemplate. Because we're trying to explain what quit moving when God just said, no, it's going to stay daylight in Gibeon until they're done. The sun's going to stay up there in that same spot. When they look at it, every time they look up, the sun's going to be in the same spot until they get this battle done. In my honest opinion, but this is just an opinion, it's no better than anybody else's. It's no better than saying the earth quit rotating. My honest opinion is the whole universe just stopped. We're going to leave everything right where it's at till you guys are done. That's not hard for God, is it?
No, nothing is.
And so we get caught up in these ways of trying to analyze miracles, and we really can't. Really, the right answer is I don't have any idea what happened. Something stopped. And I am confident that it stayed daylight as long as they needed it to get this battle done. And by estimation, it was about a whole nother day that they had to do the battle. And so in the book of the upright, it's recorded in the wars of the Lord. Numbers 21 is where it talks about that. And that's the bronze serpent. And how everybody that looked at the bronze serpent was healed. It said that's in the books of the wars. So there were some other writings that you could go to that the writer of Joshua says, I'm not the only one saying this. You need a little...
Collaboration.
No, not collaboration. That's when you work together. Corroboration, then it's out there. And you know it, essentially. These are things the writer of the book expects them to know about. And so, in verse 15, what does Joshua and company do after the battle is basically over? Go back to Gilgal. Gilgal, next to Jericho, which is just ashes over there, has become their central point of operation. So now let's go to Joshua chapter 10, And we're going to look at verses 16 through 28. Let me glance at something here real quick. Okay, we'll see how far we get in this. Now, these five kings had fled and hidden themselves in the cave at Makkedah. It was told Joshua, saying, "The five kings have been found hidden in the cave at Makkedah." Joshua said, "Roll large stones against the mouth of the cave and assign men by it to guard them. But do not stay there yourselves. Pursue your enemies and attack them in the rear. Do not allow them to enter their cities, for the Lord your God has delivered them into your hand." It came about that when Joshua and the sons of Israel had finished slaying them with a very great slaughter, until they were destroyed and the survivors who remained of them had entered the fortified cities, that all the people returned to the camp to Joshua at Makkedah in peace. No one uttered a word against any of the sons of Israel. Then Joshua said, "Open the mouth of the cave and bring these five kings out to me from the cave." They did so and brought these five kings out to them from the cave: the king of Jerusalem, the king of Hebron, the king of Jarmuth, the king of Lachish, and the king of Eglon. When they brought these kings out to Joshua, Joshua called for all the men of Israel and said to all the chiefs of the men of war who had gone with him, "Come near, put your feet on the necks of these kings." So they came near and put their feet on their necks. Joshua then said to them, "Do not fear or be dismayed. Be strong and courageous, for thus the Lord will do to all your enemies with whom you fight." So afterward, Joshua struck them, put them to death, and he hanged them on five trees. And they hung on the trees until evening. It came about at sunset that Joshua gave a command, and they took them down from the trees and threw them into the cave where they had hidden themselves, and put large stones over the mouth of the cave to this very day. So this clearly, we're backing up a little bit in time. It's in the midst of the battle. Joshua and company have returned to Gilgal. There are others still out fighting and pursuing, and they come in and tell Joshua, "Those five kings are in a cave over at Makkedah." And when he gets the word, he says, "Put large stones in front of the mouth and put some guards there, but don't stop your fighting. Keep on pursuing the fleeing armies and attack them in the rear. Don't let them get into their cities. Yahweh has given these men to you." Joshua and the armies completed the great slaughter, and the remaining survivors then were in the fortified cities. So they've done all they can do. There's a few that have escaped to the cities, but Joshua and the armies have killed the rest. So the people come back to the camp at Makkedah in peace. What an interesting emotional time that must have been. You know, they've been out all day long, extended long day, fighting and watching the death and the judgment of God being handed out through their hands and their great successes. And here they are now back there in peace. And interestingly, in verse 21, it says, no one was talking against Israel. Well, that makes sense from a couple of ways. One is, would you want it to say, you guys are a bunch of jerks at that moment? You wouldn't live very long, would you? Of course, that's irrelevant because all the enemies were already dead. So how could anybody be talking against Israel? But then Joshua says, all right, we're all back here together. This is a peaceful moment. Bring out the five kings. And so they bring these five kings over, and Joshua calls the men of Israel out, and they can see them. And he calls the chief leaders, and he says, come over here and put your foot on the neck of the kings. Why do you suppose he had them do that? There's several reasons. Some of you probably quickly would know. Why would Josh say, put your foot on their necks? Well, they're going to kill them, but there's another symbolic thing going on here. That was their way of showing victory over somebody, was to put your foot on their neck and you've got them. I mean, they know they're had, and they're not going to fight back. You've got them in a situation where they're probably going to die anyway, but they're defeated thoroughly. And so Joshua's making a point. Look at our victories here. There's five kings down there. Did Joshua and company initiate the events that led to the attack against these five kings? Huh? No? Somebody say no? Who initiated it? Huh?
The kings did.
Yeah, the kings did. These five kings said, look what happened over here. We've got the people at Gibeon who made a treaty. We got to go take them out before we have to fight them. So Joshua, at that moment, there's nothing recorded that he was planning any soon attack. But these five kings show up, and the Gibeonites say, hey, we're in trouble. All right, so they marched up there. These five kings hurried their destruction. They hurried their destruction by deciding to take matters in their own hands and come against the one true living God. They may not have seen it that way. They thought they were going against the Gibeonites. But in reality, they were down to interrupt the plans of the one true living God. And the one true living God said, well, okay, come on. I'm not that he was surprised, but come on, Joshua. Don't be afraid. You're going to win. I've already determined the outcome of this battle. And so he sends them up. And they actually hurried this area of the conquest. Because he wipes out, in this situation, the main kings of this hill country. And now they've got these five kings there. And so there's been a defeat. It's a defeat that came from God itself. And they're just responding to what's happening as Israelites in the direction of God that gives them. And so this is a very real event. And Joshua's saying, look at where God has put us. We have defeated these kings. Be strong. Don't have any dismay. Dismay could be fright. It could be discouragement. It could be concern about the future, fear of the unknown. Joshua says, none of that. You've got it right in front of you, what God has done in our conquest in this arena, in this area of the promised land, of the Canaanite areas. We've got five kings here that have been defeated. And he goes on to say, this is what you can expect Yahweh to do in all of your battles. And so the kings are killed. They're displayed by being hung on five trees until evening. At sunset, they take them down. They're thrown in a cave. And they put large stones over the mouth that, according to the writer, at the time he wrote it, they're here to this day. And so then Joshua went in and captured Makkedah that day. They utterly destroyed it, its king and its people, just like Jericho. This is quite a day. This is quite a day. These kings came down to make trouble for Israel, who were worshiping and faithfully at this point serving the one true living God. And I don't know what the numbers of soldiers were and what the battle was to be like, but when God himself fought on behalf of Israel and took out more people, more soldiers than the Israelites themselves did, it wasn't much of a real battle. What's the battle in recent times that people talk about that was short in duration? I just told my age, because I'm going to say recent times. When we talk about, you know, that's not very recent if you're a young person. Well, Iraq went quick, and that's true. Seven-day war of Israel? Is that right? Six-day war.
It was a six-day.
Six-day war. And so, you know, in just a few days, Israel was attacked, and they were going to take out the nation of Israel. Didn't quite work that way. Israel wound up with an awful lot of their territory, historically, their territory, back in their hands.
They gave it all back.
Well, they've given most of it back in various ways, but that's really not the issue at the moment. The issue is, we think of those things as lightning quick. Wow, that war went quick. Not like this. I mean, there is no candle to be held to this. In a day, they took out all, you know, they were city kings for the most part, and they took them out in one 24-hour period. It's amazing what happens when God's will is involved, because God's will always gets done. Questions, comments? So there's a verse we like to quote, and put our own spin on it often. In Romans chapter 8, all things what? Work together for the good of those who love God and are called according to his purpose. We should have as much confidence in that verse as we do, as these folks did, in what it was going to mean to fight the battles. But here's where we go wrong. We put our own spin on it. We often think that that verse means that all things ought to work out so that I feel good about how they worked out, so I'm confident, so I'm happy, and please me. Oh, it didn't say work out for your will, did it? And it even can become a dividing line between those of us who are mostly concerned about glorifying God versus pleasing ourselves. Look at what Paul went through. He's the one that wrote the verse, and yet he's the one that endured all manner of physical oppression and imprisonment and betrayal by his own friends. And you could go down the list. And yet Paul says, all things work together for good to those that love God and are called according to his purpose. If you love God and are called according to his purpose, you're concerned about his purposes, not yours. And so when the world goes sideways, and it does, I don't know, the world looks like it's set up for quite a sideways shift, doesn't it? When the world goes sideways, God didn't lose control for that minute, that year, that decade, those centuries, whatever they are, God's still controlling things so he can see that his purposes are met. It might be the way that he is bringing about his own testimony to the world. When does the church flourish historically the most? When it's persecuted. You want to have a good testimony? Pray for persecution. Oh, you don't really feel like doing that, and I don't either. And I think you'd be crazy to actually pray for the persecution, but we certainly ought to be praying for our own testimony in this world we lived in that's so mixed up and crazy. Questions? Comments? All right, next time we'll start out with verse 29.